was the blackest night. There was no moon in sight. You know the stars ain't shining cause the sky's too tight. Heard the scary wind, I seen some ugly trees. There was a werewolf honking along the side of me. I'm mean and I'm bad, you know I ain't no sissy. Got a big titty girlie by the name of Chrissy. Talking about her in my life and me. And this ride up the mountain, a mystery, mystery. I know this, even the crickets acting weird up here. And so I figured I might just drink a little beer. I said, give me some of that, what you sucking on? But there was no reply, cause she was gone. Where's those titties I like so well? And my goddamn beer is what I started to yell. Then I heard this noise like a crunch of twig. And up jumped the devil, he's about this big. He had a red suit on and a widow's peak. And then a pointed tail and like a sulfur reek. That's right, it was him all right. I swear I know it was. He had some human flesh stuck underneath his claws. You know it looked to me like it was titty skin. I said, you son of a bitch, cause I was mad at him. Well, he just got out his floss and started cleaning his fangs. So I shot him with my shooter, said, bang, bang, bang. And then the sucker just laughed and said, put it away, you know I ate all up. Now what you gonna say? You ate my Chrissy?
Yeah, titties and all.
Well, what about the beer then?
Now were the cans this tall?
Even her boots?
Would I lie to you?
Shit, you must have been hungry.
Yeah, this is true.
Well, don't they pay you good for the stuff that you do?
Well, you know, I can't complain when the checks come through.
Well, I want my Chrissy.
Oh, yeah?
And I want my beer, so you just barf it back up. Now, devil, do you hear?
Blow it out your ass, motorcycle man! I mean, I am the devil, do you understand? Just what will you give me for your titties and beer? I suppose you noticed this little contract here.
You're goddamn right, you son of a whore. That's about the only reason I learned writing for.
Oh, yeah?
Give me that paper. Bet your mask I'll sign because I need a beer and it's titty squeezing time.
Man, you can't fool me. You ain't that bad.
Oh, yeah?
Why, you should have seen some of the souls that I had. Man, there was Milhouse Nixon and Agnew too. And both of those suckers was worse than you.
Well, let's make a deal if you think that's true. I mean, you're supposed to be the devil, so what you gonna do?
Well, I don't know, man. You know, maybe you aren't the right cat for the job after all.
Hey, listen, you can have my soul. It's a mean little sucker about 1,000 years old. But once you get it, you can't give it back. You gotta keep it forever, and that's a natural fact.
Forever? Now wait, wait a minute.
That's right.
Now I'm really sure that, I don't think you're the right guy.
Hey, listen, I'm the kind of a person, I don't mind going to hell so long as I get a good deal, you know?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, are you the kind of a person that will give me a good deal?
I don't know, man. I don't
know. Hey, look,
know.
I'll tell you what. I'll give anything to make this deal. Can we negotiate?
Well, you know,
All right, look. If I go down there, can I take some other people with me?
Well, that all depends, man.
Can we make a package deal?
Maybe, you know, what have you got in mind, man?
Well, I was thinking about taking everybody who works for Warner Brothers Records.
I wouldn't mind having them down there.
And their legal department.
Yeah?
Can you arrange that?
Yeah, I can be arranged. What do you want to do with those suckers?
Hey, well, listen, once they get down there, can I arrange some of the entertainment for them, you know, because I've been in the entertainment business for 13 years now. I'd like to show those people from Warner Brothers a really good time, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, what did you have in mind for them, man?
Are you familiar with a device known in the trade as the Tower of Power?
The Tower of Power?
Yeah.
And you're looking at the inventor of the Tower of Power.
You invented the Tower of Power?
You mean the Tower of Power?
Right.
The little wooden mahogany-based spindle-like object, kind of like a stool with a pink rubber anal plug in the middle of it?
Right, that's the thing, the Tower of Power.
Of course I know what the Tower of Power is.
All right, I want you to fix up a special matched set of Towers of Power for all of the people who work for Warner Brothers Records and for their legal department.
Yeah?
Now, I want these modifications. Now, ordinarily, this aforementioned Tower of Power contains a pink vinyl anal plug.
Yeah.
Well, I want to have the plug on this particular set of Towers of Power. I want them made out of carborundum.
Yeah.
With a built-in rechargeable hand grenade spindle.
Oh, yeah.
And I want the aforementioned elaborated spindle attached to a... Oh, let's just call it about a 30-horsepower motor, so it swivels really nice.
Yeah.
Okay, you can arrange all of this?
Oh, yeah, man. This can all be taken care of.
Can you arrange to have a Naugahyde detonator?
Yeah.
And while it's exploding over and over again up the ass of everybody who works for Warner Brothers, can you arrange to have a whole collection of Doobie Brothers, Leo Sayers albums playing in the background?
Oh, sure, man. All at the same time, of course.
How about Fleetwood Mac? Do you think
sure.
you can arrange to have all that
man.
Stuff going on there?
Yeah, we can even play them backwards for
How
them.
About some of Warner Brothers' really sharp disco music? You think you can play that for
oh,
them?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, okay then. Do we have a deal?
Man,
because along with that, all I really need is some titties and beer. Titties
what?
And beer. Titties,
titties
and beer. Titties
beer?
And beer. Titties and beer.
Oh, no.
Titties and beer.
No,
titties
no,
and beer. Titties
no,
and beer.
Wait. Oh, that's so normal. No, wait. Hold it. Hold it. Wait.
Huh?
No, don't sign it then. Give me time to think. I mean, hold on a second, boy, because that's magic here.
And then the devil barfed and out jumped my girl. They heard the titties pop, popping all around the world. She said, and then she gave us the finger, it was rigid and stiff. That's when the devil, he farted, and she went right over the cliff. The devil was mad, I took her to my pad. I swear I do declare, how did she get back there? Swear I do declare, how did she get back there? Swear I do declare.
Howdy folks, this is Scott Parker and you're listening to episode 34 of the ZappaCast for October of 2017, and it's our Halloween episode, ladies and gentlemen, and here in this particular episode we are here to direct your attention to the release of a brand new box set called Halloween 77, boys and girls, and this box set has all six shows from the October 1977 Halloween run at the Palladium in New York City. Yes, the very same one that was featured in the Baby Snakes movie and the album Baby Snakes. A legendary run of shows, legendary players, all presented in legendary sound, comes in a very, very spiffy package, which if you have not seen it, go to Zappa.com right now and check it out. It is absolutely amazing. And in this episode, we're going to give you a sneak preview of some selections from the box, mixed in with some other material from other Frank albums from that Palladium run, and one little sneaky bonus thing. But the main event for this episode is an interview with Zappa Road Crew genius extraordinaire Thomas Nordegg, and you'll definitely want to check that out because it was a lot of fun talking to him, and he has a lot of great stories, and we've only really scratched the surface of what he can tell us, boys and girls, so get ready for that. In the meantime, we're going to start with a conversation with the Vaultmeister, Mr. Joe Travers, and he's here to tell you all about Halloween 77 right here on the ZappaCast. Okay, so before we get to the main event in this episode of the ZappaCast, we are joined once again by wit, bon vivant, raconteur, and Vaultmeister for the Zappa family, Mr. Joe Travers, the kind of guy you call a friend. Hello, Joe. And we are here, the whole point of this episode, and a little later in the episode, we're going to have an interview with none other than Thomas Nordegg, so you guys want to hang out for that. You all know who he is, and we will get to him in just a little bit.
If you don't, you should.
If you don't, you should. That's right. If you don't, you should.
And you will soon.
That you absolutely will soon. He started working for Frank in the fall of 77, right around the time that Frank was gearing up to shoot a movie called Baby Snakes. And as an extension of that, there is a little project that the Zappa Family Trust is going to put out in October. And Joe, why don't you tell them a little bit about what the project is?
Well, by the time the people hear this, I mean, it's actually now.
Well, that's so true.
It's happening now.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, we are very excited to unleash onto the world Halloween 77.
Woo!
Live at the Palladium. Yeah, it's every single show that was played during the Halloween run of 1977 at the Palladium in New York City, obviously infamous because these performances were, well, not all of them, but most of them were filmed to make the Baby Snakes movie, which if anyone hasn't ever seen that movie, it's absolutely essential, and you must see it immediately, if not sooner.
Yes. It's and, a gateway drug. I call it a gateway drug. It was for me.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And it really is a peak as far as Frank in the rock world doing what he does best with a band that really smokes, as I say in the liner notes. But, you know, these shows are really, really special. And we're excited because it's not every day that we do box sets. And so this is kind of something that we are looking forward to doing more of in the future. So if you're, you know, a Zappa fan, you will be excited to know that there will be more of these types of box sets in our future, which is great. So I'm looking forward to putting those together because there really are some amazing performances to be unleashed. But this current one, again, six shows, all complete. No overdubs, hardly actually any overdubs. There are some few instances where Frank treated some of these songs with some overdubs for the movie, but we basically kept the mixes as raw and bare bones as absolutely possible, and it reflects exactly what went to tape, and we're real excited about the sound. You know, these shows, when you listen to them, you just can't believe how tight and killer the band was at that time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It was they were together, I think they were on the road for less than 2 months at this point, right?
Probably, yeah.
So I think this was a new band. I mean, if you look at it in terms of you know, in today's terms, this would definitely be considered a new band.
Mm-hmm.
Although Frank, you know, I mean, yes, Frank always had those kind of lineups, but you know, and there was a lot of turnover in the band. But, you know, this was a really interesting and unique band because it didn't really follow on from anything. This was something that was built up almost from the ground up, because if you look at the previous lineup, that was the lineup with Ray White and Eddie Jobson.
Yep.
And basically all that was kept from that band was the rhythm section. So you had Terry Bozzio and Patrick O'Hearn, and he built up from there. So
yes,
it's very impressive. And a mostly new repertoire as well, because a lot of the material from the previous band was not kept for this band, so with some exceptions.
And the things that are real special about this box set is that for the first time, because there's six shows, you literally get six different versions, you know, which is like, wow, for real? Six different versions, but of, for instance, the instrumental version of Conehead.
Yeah.
First official release of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got six different versions of Lather, also known as I Promise Not to Come in Your Mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only official version that's ever been released of that is on Zappa New York, so it's great to hear, you know, six other versions of that song, and because it's such a beautiful song, and it's great to hear the arrangements from this group. And then, of course, you have the massive solo workout of Wild Love.
Yeah.
Major.
Just
major, major cool stuff going on with those tracks, and that, those, to me, are some of the highlights of the box and of the shows, and so very exciting. The packaging is real special. Amit was behind a lot of what you're going to be getting. I don't want to completely spoil it for you, but I know that for those of you who may even have it as we're listening to this podcast, you'll notice that there's a couple different ways that you can buy this thing. You can buy a physical box set, which features a costume, which is really funny and great. And inside that physical box, you will have a USB stick, which will include 44 1K 24-bit audio of all six shows on a USB stick.
Wow.
So the quality is real good, and you can obviously burn your own CDs if you want to listen to it in your car. But these days, you don't even need to. Most cars have these USB things. You can just stick it right in there and just play it sometimes, yeah. I think, you know. But anyway, and then there will be the option to buy each individual show as a download. So let's say you don't want to spend the money on the entire box, and you were only interested in the 30th or the second show on the 28th or something like that. You have the option of just buying that show if you want. And then there are people that appreciate the quality of CD and still want something that is a physical product but don't want to spend the money on the entire box. There is a 3-CD set that features the Halloween show with some bits and pieces from the 30th show. The show on the 30th was on a Sunday, I think, and it was a matinee show.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. So there's some really fun things that happen on that show, including a Halloween treat with Thomas Nordegg. and as you know, we have Thomas Nordegg on the show, so you'll be hearing more and more about that. It was really great, too, because right before we did the interview, Scott, I sent that track to Thomas, and it was the first time that he had ever heard that since it happened.
Wow. 40 years ago.
So, yeah. And that's another thing, is that obviously this celebrates the 40th anniversary of these performances. So so that's what's going on. Halloween 77, coming at ya.
Don't scratch your love. Don't scratch your love.
Don't scratch your love. My baby's
gone. Don't scratch your love. Don't scratch your love. Don't scratch your love. She don't feel it fit like a glove.
That little girl's got the Jones. That little girl's got the Jones.
Grind up the Jones, grind up the Jones, grind up the Jones.
What's it going to do?
Grind up the Jones, grind up the Jones, grind up the Jones. She don't ever want to be in love.
She can push, she can shove, tell her just enough. She can push, she can shove, tell her just enough. Just enough.
Here she comes with the red dress on. Steve shoots out from the speakers all along. As we rolling on the concrete floor. The wind can't blow cause the sky's gone. The wind can't blow cause the sky's gone. The wind can't blow cause the sky's gone. The wind can't blow cause the sky's gone.
Well, see, now, Frank recorded these. Were they 24-track?
Yes, 24-track, 2-inch, Scotch 3M masters, and every one of them had to be heat-treated before transfer.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah, so we had to bake them all, and we transferred them all from scratch, and I sat very closely with Craig Parker Adams
yep.
And his assistant, and we mixed every single show from scratch. Now, I will say that it was definitely a task because Craig had to do some, what would you want to call it, some sound enhancement to some of this stuff. Not a lot of it, but there were some definite problems with some of the tapes. And when you listen to this stuff, you can realize that with what Frank had to work with back in the 70s, there was no way he could make it any better. So it's interesting to think that he didn't release more from these shows because, like, for instance, on the first show, the left channel of Peter Wolf's synth track, there's like a bad cable, so it's all distorted and screwed up. So we had to omit that channel, which made it mono. So we had to, you know, do that just for the first show. They obviously caught it. They caught it for the second show on the first night, so yay to that.
But then, you were able to save Peter's keyboard track. It's just mono.
Yeah, we took the left channel, and we took away the channel that was all screwed up, and we just left the other channel there and then treated it and EQ'd it and such. And then Ed Mann, for his track, unfortunately, there's a lot of ambient bleed and some weird erroneous patching going on. There was a lot of open live mics around his setup, and so the clarity of the percussion is kind of drowned in the stage volume of all the rest of the stuff that's going on around him. And so whenever you turn that track up, it actually affects the entire mix because there's so much bleed and so much ambient stuff going on. So unfortunately for some of the shows, the clarity of Ed's performance is a little buried. But whenever he would play the marimba with hard mallets, or whenever he would play the beltree or some of the real high-end piercing kind of attacky type instruments in his setup, you can hear that real well. So yay to that. And then there was an issue with the kick drum on one of the recording. There were two recording machines in the RCA mobile truck.
Yeah.
And the kick drum was clean on one machine, but on the other machine, it was real distant, and you had the attack, but you didn't have the warmth and the bottom end on that machine. It almost sounded to me like it was another one of those cases where, like, it was just like a bad chord somewhere there was just a bad patch, and the signal wasn't coming in as strong on that machine as it was on the first machine. So Craig had to do a lot of replacement for that kick drum for whenever the show goes to that machine. You know, whenever we're using source material that was recorded on that machine, we had to fix it. We had to fix it. And I'll tell you, Craig did an amazing job, and you absolutely cannot tell. You cannot tell that it's that some of that kick drum has been replaced. But I mean, these are the types of things that you run into in the vault, because, you know, these are the types of things that Frank ran into.
Sure.
And but, you know, Frank didn't have Pro Tools at his disposal and all these different things that you can do nowadays digitally to restore some of the bad things that happened were there. So sonic restoration is what I was trying to say before. That's the thing that Craig did a lot of on this stuff, and he did an amazing job, and real happy about the final result of the sound of these of these shows and these mixes. And we really went out of our way to accentuate what happened those nights and not do like fake audience, you know, like sometimes, you know, a lot of producers will just stick in, you know, an audience roar. Here.
Eddie Kramer.
Well, it's so protocol when you're releasing a live album and you want it produced and you want it to be all hyped and everything like that. But the thing about the New York crowd is, number one, you don't have to do that because they were already hyped and they were really great anyway. Mm-hmm. Second of all, I wanted to make sure that none of that fakery was going on in these shows. So everything that you hear is exactly how it happened.
Do you think that Frank probably wouldn't have faked any of that for the Baby Snakes movie or any of that, right? He didn't add in.
No, but he did double track his vocals, and he did on certain songs, and he did, and to a great effect as well. I mean, it really does enhance his voice when you watch the movie, you know.
Yeah.
And there's some keyboard overdubs on certain songs, and some percussion overdubs on a couple things, just to make the parts clearer, because like I told you, some of Ed's tracks just don't cut because of the way that they were recorded.
Yeah.
So there are some things that he did, but we chose to make sure that we didn't want to take anything away from what those mixes were that Frank made, but we wanted to keep this as raw and live as possible and try not to make it like, we didn't want to produce it like Frank would. We just wanted to show from an archival point of view what happened during these shows and what these tapes captured, you know?
Yeah.
And Kerry McNabb was the engineer that recorded this stuff in the truck, and I'm pretty sure that it was one of the very last projects Kerry ever did with Frank. And we know that Kerry had a long history with Frank. He started in 1972 mm-hmm. recording the Grand Wazoo and the Waka Jawaka albums at Paramount.
Yeah.
And then he went on the road in 73. In fact, Road Tapes 2 was recorded by Kerry on the road.
Yeah.
But Kerry started to phase himself out of the business right around the late 70s. And I'm pretty sure that Joe Ciccarelli stepped in after Kerry McNabb went away when they started recording Joe's Garage and the Village Recorders in 79.
Yeah.
So this was probably one of the last things that Kerry did.
Hey, I'm only 14, sickly in fear. Tried all of my life just to grow me a chin. Popped out once, yeah, but my dad pushed me in. Tell me, why did he hurt me? Now he, my dad's a kid. He's a Mexican.
So that Frank kind of went, I mean, he went all out to capture this because obviously he had film element, that, you know, or the film that he was making. So,
absolutely.
You know, so this was, so do you think he was, you know, because you've said there are certain problems, say, on the first show that don't appear on other nights. And of course, they wouldn't have altered the setup because they were there for that residency. So do you think that Frank was actually monitoring or listening back to these tapes like the next day and then making changes? Or do you think that they just kind of changed on the fly because they could hear what was going on?
I'm pretty sure that Carrie and some of the other people that were working in the truck were probably noticing these things. The kick drum, unfortunately, went unnoticed for many shows, and then near the end of the run, especially for the Halloween show itself, it had gotten fixed. So yay to that.
Yeah.
But I don't think Frank was monitoring the stuff that much because the tracks don't change. The track assignments don't change, and everything's really consistent. And you know, he obviously had his hands full. You know what I mean? He
was
filming and rehearsing in the day and all that stuff. So, and man, two shows on the 28th, two shows on the 29th. That's four, and then a long show on the 30th, and then a show on the 31st, and that's all six.
Yeah, that's
so. That's a lot of playing.
That's a lot of playing.
And, you know, originally those shows got sold out, and they added those second shows. They added that stuff to Ron Delsner added that because of the demand.
Oh, so it was supposed to be one show a night.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's true. And it was either supposed to be one show a night, or I think the 30th was added.
Mm-hmm.
Just one, that show was added, and maybe, I don't know for sure, but I do know that extra shows were added to the run because of the demand and the sales. So yay.
Yeah. He was kind of at a peak at that time, wasn't he? As far as his attendance.
So. Yeah, I really think so. I mean, he had been touring for a long time in the 70s, and he had his reputation, he had his fan base, and he had records that were selling real well, and he had an amazing band. I mean, he really was. I'm so glad that he filmed the stuff and that Baby Snakes is an entity, because it really is amazing.
Yeah, I'm not sure when he actually conceived of the idea of filming for a major motion picture, which is, in fact, what Baby Snakes was. It wasn't, you know, like you get today, like a direct-to-DVD, you know, concert or something like that. This was a major motion picture that appeared in theaters.
Yes, it did.
So it was his second major motion picture after 200 Motels, so it was a big deal. And I mean, it took a lot of faith in that band to have him set that all in motion, because, you know, I mean, that it just goes to show you how great, you know, or how much faith he had in that band.
Yeah. And the package also features some really great memoirs from that time period, from people that were there. You know, including band members. We have really nice liner notes from Adrian Belew, and we have a real nice memoir from Ed Mann.
Oh, and really?
And we've got amazing pictures, Polaroid snapshots that were taken by Phil Kaufman, who was the road manager at the time.
Yeah, Phil.
And Phil was so kind to lend us his scrapbook, and it made up a lot of the packaging for the digital booklet. And then we've got Janet the Planet, who wrote some nice things in there.
Yeah.
And I wrote a little something something in there too. And it's just really nice to hear the stories from the people that were there. You know, Thomas wrote liners as well. So there's a lot of real special moments captured in text from the people that were there. And real happy about this box set, for sure. I think that I don't think that there's any reason for anybody to not be happy with this.
Yeah, I would say not, considering how all out you're going. This is actually in a box.
Absolutely. There's a physical box, and then as I said before, you can get the complete box digitally. You could buy a show separately if you choose, or you could buy just the Halloween show on a three CD set.
Wow. See, you have to remember, folks, you're not a hardcore maniac with a complete record collection, as Frank would say, if you don't have the actual box. So you know you want it. You have to go get it.
Absolutely. So happy Halloween to everybody. And look forward to hearing the comments about this. And if I may say so, we've got another special event happening in December.
Ooh.
Along these lines, and that's all I can say for now, but I think you're all going to be happy with that too. So here's to some great Vault Zappa coming out this year.
Yep, see? The torture never stops.
All green and buzzing in his mansion of despair. Prisoners grumble and kiss their clothes and scratch their muddied hair. A tiny light from a window hole 100 yards away is all they ever get to know about the regular life in the day. And it stinks so bad, the stone's been choking, and whooping really stops. In the room where the giant lie above the woods, the torture never stops. Yeah, torture never stops. The torture never stops. Thank you, Sue and Michelle. Spears by the iron door. Knives and spikes and guns in the legs of a Hillary to a pipe. And a sinister midget with a bucket and a mop where the blood goes down the drain. And it stinks so bad, the stone's been choking and ripping greenish drops. In the room where the giant fire above the works, the torture never stops. The torture never stops. The torture never stops. A steaming pig in a chamber right near there. He eats the snouts and the trotter's spurs, the loins and the groins is soon dispersed. His carving style is well rehearsed. All men be cursed. All men be cursed. Up there too. All men be cursed. all men be cursed and disagree well. No one durst. He's the best of course and all the worst.
He's the best of course of all the worst.
Some wrong been done, he done it first.
Some wrong been done, he done it first.
And he stinks so bad, his bones been choking, and we've been good as drops. In the night of the iron sausage, where the torture never stops. The torture never stops. The torture, the torture, the torture never stops.
All right, you people want to get tortured tonight or what? All right.
Thank you.
all green and buzzing in his dungeon of despair. Who are all these people that he's locked away down there? Are they crazy? Are they sainted? Are they zero? Someone painted. It has never been explained since at first it was created. But a dungeon, just like a sin, requires nothing but locking in of everything that's ever been. Look at her. Look at her. That's what's the deal with you. What's the deal with living? That's what's the deal with living. That's what's the deal we're dealing in.
And now for the big event on this episode of the Zappacast. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a couple of very, 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 very fine fellows here calling from Los Angeles. The Vaultmeister himself, you know him, you love him, Mr. Joe Travers.
Well, hi. And we have on the line here.
Straight from Vienna to you, one of the, you guys know him. You've welcomed him into your homes and your hearts, and you've seen him on lots of stages over the years and heard lots of stories, I'm quite sure. Mr. Thomas Nordegg.
Wow.
So welcome to the show. Hey!
Hey, it's Will back.
You know what? You know what's great about this? Michael Sherwood wanted you on here for the longest time.
Oh, so wonderful. Yeah, I met him when I was at Capitol Records. He was working with the artist John Spicer, and that's when I met him. And oh my God, yeah, what a wonderful person, indeed. He knows Frank's music also so well. That's, you know, it's just totally deep inside, so really nice.
And we've been trying to get you on the show for some time now, so it's quite an honor to have you here. I mean, really is. So I think people are going to really love this.
All good.
So I wanted to just give people a brief idea of, the brief version of your story, which is, of course, out there, and I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to the show would know it, but how does a young man such as yourself get from Vienna to the United States and then ultimately in a position where he winds up under the employment of a composer of Sicilian descent?
Well, I when I was in my Austrian years, around in the 60s, the Beatles showed up on this planet, and so that intrigued me to, you know, wanting music, interested me. Before that, I knew about Elvis Presley, Harry Belafonte, whatever, my little years, or the Austrian hits parade, you know. But because of the Beatles, I thought, well, I want to play in a band too. And so I was in the band in Vienna, Austria, and we actually cut a couple record tracks. So then I heard in Vienna about a band called The Slaves, who supposedly had the guy on guitar, a gypsy guitarist that couldn't read or write, but played accordingly. And I went and saw The Slaves, and I said, well, it's all good. I do not have to play the guitar at all. It's all there already. And, so I somewhat, long story that would be, ended up becoming his manager. Not that I knew at all what I was had to do or what have you, but with him, I went to America in 1972, and well, that would be a Quentin Tarantino movie if you would write the script right now. Very adventurous for 2 years. You know, we got a record deal, and just it was very, very wonderful years. Too long right now to get into, but we went back with some American musicians, did a tour to Austria, and after that, I was in Vienna for a year or two, and I hooked up again with Peter Wolf, who before I went to America with Ratzer, Charlie Ratzer, we already were working in Austria at basically, so to speak, a best band called Gypsy Love, and Peter, yeah, keyboard player, and other cousins of Ratzer, all Gypsies, drums, and so yeah, we were had a good situation, and Wolf was supposedly to come along with Ratzer and me. We had sort of a triumvirate entertainers management contract, but Wolf was already married. He couldn't leave at that point. So anyway, in 75, 76, I think I went back with Peter, and so the trip was from the started in New York and ended up, we had the goal to make it to L.A. or the music metropole, and well, we were just about out of money, of course, but the early days stayed in motels, and Alfonso Johnson, who we knew, sure, from Weather Report, bass player from Vienna, he was a friend, and I knew Javino, of course, so he invited us, so we went to his home in Culver City for dinner, and then he said, well, George Duke is playing tonight at the Roxy, so you want to come along? So we went, and there I saw Buddy Miles, the drummer, mm-hmm, who supposedly was with had a sort of hooked up, so to speak, with my Gypsy guitar player's stepsister, because when I came to the States with Charlie, he did bring his girlfriend and his well-endowed stepsister, and so she at this point Rufus was already in existence, and when I came with Ratzer, the first band we joined in New York City at the Gaslight was a band from LA called High Voltage. Mm-hmm. Like nine-piece band, I think one white guy, all black guys, horn section, smoking band, and Tony Maiden, the guitarist, mm-hmm, and Bobby Watson, the bass player, were then later on founding member of Rufus. So, which already was at the time when I came back with Peter, and Trouty, Charlie's stepsister, she was with Buddy Miles, and so I walked up to him and said, wow, you know where Trouty is? We are from Vienna, you know, we are long-time friends, so we hooked up, and well, we moved in with Charlie in an apartment right on Crescent Heights in Santa Monica, and went to the guitar center every day. There was only one in all of America on Sunset, opposite where it's now, and Peter trying out gear every day, always what's the latest, what have you, and we had a phone, landline of course, and we exchanged phone numbers, and it was, God, literally maybe 3 months into it, where the phone rang, and it said, hi, this is Frank Zappa, and I talked to Peter Wolf. And of course, right after the phone call, Frank wanted us to drive up, so we went up to Woodrow Wilson, and that's when I met Frank, that up close, and the first time, and I'd say at that point, I'd probably seen about, probably 10 Mothers of Inventions up to Frank Zappa shows throughout the years. Peter auditioned for 2 days and got the gig, and Frank hired me as his roadie, and well, there you have it. That was, you know, we were in, so to speak, and it was the best time of my life, no question about it, with Frank and with the family, and you know, of course, the shows. You know, what can I say? That I wouldn't be talking to you if it wasn't about Frank, you know, and that goes for so many people, you know, what he, everybody that crossed Frank's path, you know, was blessed beyond, and that's how I feel. So yeah, so that's how I, and we, Peter and myself, hooked up with Frank Zappa. Thank you.
That's amazing. So did you know all this stuff, Joe?
I did. Not that many details, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, I knew that he had come with Peter. You know, the first tour that he was on was the 77 tour.
Yes. Fall of 77.
And obviously, you know, with the new release of the Halloween 77 that's coming out this Halloween, as we know, which would be tomorrow if this plays on the 30th.
Mm-hmm.
But we're really happy because Thomas contributed to the packaging doing some liner notes for it, which I thought were really, really great. And, you know, he kind of explains a little bit about the story that you just heard, too. But, you know, he is part of legend, you know, now, and he is part of this special Halloween run. And I just wanted to ask Thomas if he had any specific memories of those shows at the Palladium in 77 that were filmed, which ended up being the Baby Snakes movie, if he had any specific memories, and especially if he remembered being asked to do the card tricks with Peter and with Roy Estrada on stage.
Yes. I mean, this brought it all back. Like, I would not have really been able to get a grip on it, but now, after hearing it, I totally remember. And, you know, the whole thing was so intense in a good and also in a strange way, because that tour started, and the second show, I think, was in Las Vegas at the original Aladdin Theater still.
Mm-hmm.
For me, my first time, of course, Las Vegas, and Frank Zappa, you know, in the semi-truck. I mean, I was so overwhelmed from A to Z, you know. And also, as Frank did it, and I mentioned that in my liner notes, and Frank's crew, everybody was helping. When the bus got there, everybody got out and helped with the lights. Frank owned his own lights and helped with the sound setting up and then the back line and so forth.
Then enter Phil Kaufman. Right, Thomas?
Correct, yes. Phil Kaufman.
Yes. Yep. And I'm pleased to say that Phil also contributed some memories to the package of Halloween 77. So, yay to that. Yay to Phil. His contribution is unbelievable with the Polaroids that he took, which are just absolutely an amazing collection of Polaroid shots and scrapbook items. And Thomas got to see some of those. What kind of memories did that bring back, Thomas?
Well, again, just the whole thing was so overwhelming. I remember what I did, you know, as I tried to, whatever, you know, do something good. I remember I taped on the way from the dressing room to the stage, sort of, with white tape, I guess, at that point. Mm. I made sort of arrows and then wrote down, "Welcome to NYC, as we welcome to NYC," and also just... So these are little things, you know, that Frank said, "Wow, this is nice," and you know, he walked off the stage, and just the whole atmosphere. Frank, the shows were, you know, it just every day new, every day different, and just a real event. It was never a routine, you know. It was always, best in show every night to me. And sometimes when I said to Frank, there was video cameraman later on, and I remember, mm-hmm. I said to Frank, "Wow, man, this was a great show." And Frank goes, "You sure fooled them."
Oh, God.
So Frank kind of took to you very quickly then, didn't he, Thomas? Because you were...
Yeah. Well, I was sort of interested in the video... in videotaping and so forth, and the cameras, if they became available, you know, not kit cameras at that point, but, you know, the tubes. So Frank suggested, and Frank said, "Yep, get this, and this, we do record and all that." And so I outfitted myself, and the way we had it was pretty cool, even though the cameras were not, you know, I mean, it's consumer cameras, but nonetheless, the video went straight outside to the recording truck. I had a cable alongside my along my back and along my pants with Velcro straps, you know, came up right off my heel. I I had this black, yellow, black, yellow, black, yellow, so everyone could see it, and I could walk along pretty freely, and the picture went straight to the recording truck. So where the engineer put a proper stereo track live on it, you know. So that was obviously wonderful, and Frank allowing me, you know, to do this every night. I had the idea to get a semi fisheye super wide angle onto the camera with one lens. So I got two car hose clamps, bigger ones, that I made a little hinge. I mounted on it with two springs. So I put one side on the camera lens, and the other one was on that semi fisheye, so I could pop that in on the beat, you know, if I wanted, and that sort of a, you know, extra, like a second camera, so to speak. That was, you know, made it interesting. And Frank, you know, supported me on all that. And my dream back then, of course, today, all reality, my dream was always to have the viewfinder on my face, on my eyes, so, you know, so I could walk around totally free. I mean, that's
right.
Mm-hmm. Once you do that, you have to totally learn, because it's always, everything is reversed. And I even modified a viewfinder on the camera with a 45-degree angle mirror onto one of my eyes. Oh, which I had it, you know, very archaic. But you know, so all this, you know, today obviously we put those visors on and we are virtual augmented reality already. But Frank was so supportive, and you know, it was just wonderful from every aspect, and the band, the players, and you know, the whole regiment and Frank's music, you know, I mean, how, there's nothing better, you know, Frank did it all, everything.
Thank you.
it's just amazing. Like, when you think about the first band, the first of Frank's bands that you saw, and in the stunt guitar position, you have Adrian Ballou,
right,
and of course Peter Wolf and Ed Mann on percussion, and of course Tommy Mars.
Nice.
Yeah. And you did, you were keyboard tech at the time, were you not, for Peter and Tommy?
Yeah, for Tommy.
That's why. So, how did you, were you as familiar, I mean, say, because I think most people would know you now as one of the elite guitar techs in the business, and have been for a number of years, but did you have a great working knowledge? I mean, you must have, obviously.
No, not really. I really learned it with Frank. I just watched, and I was very intimidated. I remember the Davey Moore, the house engineer, whatever. So he made me that cable like a couple extra electronics on it, and I was like, oh my god, what? Till I finally learned there's only plus and minus, that's how the universe works, and then you know, so I learned very long. But I knew as far as the keyboards goes, because Peter Wolf, even in Austria before we came to the States, had to have always the latest gear. So we had, you know, and the Rhodes piano, well, it's a Mini Moog R2600, you know, all this, that stuff I was so familiar. And Frank had the CS80, the big Yamaha keyboard for Tommy and for Peter, and Tommy brought in the vocoder, which, you know, was a great tool that Peter also had. And then we had the Yamaha Grand piano, the collapsible one. So, you know, whatever it took, it made sure it was there. And so that's how I really learned. And having said that, you know, I was, as I mentioned before, we learned even how to set up the lights, how to, you know, connect or the stage flooring. And I remember a little episode I want to mention about David Robb, who was such a prominent also experience in my life. Frank's the second tech when I joined Frank.
Yeah.
He used to work for Jimi Hendrix, actually, and, you know, Todd Rundgren.
Wow.
A really very brilliant guy, rabbi we called him, like a long beard, long black hair. didn't talk all day, and a huge collapsible, almost a wardrobe chest with all these parts and stuff. Great job. And I was also in charge of rolling out the flooring, the Maori flooring for schools, so, you know, the same setup every day. And he would always come along and help me roll it out on the, you know, on the floor, to, you know. And I said, David, no, it's okay. It's really, you don't do that. But he was on his knees there, and he's on the floor, you know. He goes, there is no job as low as not worth to do it right. So, yeah, David Graf was another great, you know, encounter that I had, thanks to Frank, obviously.
Hey, Thomas, was David working for Frank in 1977, or is that the 80s?
I think later, yeah. I forgot the fellow's name now, yeah. And then David Gray, for a while, was actually on stage. After the first guy, David Gray came in, you know, who, as you know, is Dolby president these days.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he was Frank's tech. And then there's David Robb, he was really, really great guy, very knowledgeable. And from him, obviously, I learned a lot. So, Frank, you know, that came up as a topic at some point where, you know, we're saying, God, it would be great if there was a, you know, a school curriculum where you would learn how to be a guitar, well, today they call guitar tech, or a roadie, you know, a backline, or you know how to set up drums, or a production manager, or a tour manager, whatever. And, you know, Gail picked that up, I think Frank was still around, and it was called, in Frank's way, of course, ZIT, Zappa Institute of Technology, at Joan Garage. And I was teaching there, I'd say, at least three or four times for years old. When they, yearly, it was Alan Santos, production manager, and he helped coordinate it with Gail's, Gail's request. And so, yeah, that was a great thing in Frank's vein, you know, to learn, to have schooling even for, you know,
it was something that happened for a little while, and it was something that, if I remember correctly, wasn't it kind of Frank's idea to have something like that?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. And Gail then picked that idea up, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and Mark Coy, who was Frank's monitor engineer in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
he was chosen to run it for a long time, and he was, you know, very much a part of it, and because Frank always said there needed to be more people like Mark Coy in the business, right? Or like, people like that?
Yeah. And people that would, bring in the lighting designer, tour manager, riggers, whatever, that they then talk to, and a lot of actually students from these classes over the years, I know, that ended up getting great jobs. What's the fellow's name? He's been contact for with Pete Tom Petty for a long time.
Definitely.
That was always, I always liked to do that. I think I did it 4 years or so, you know.
Yeah. Now, what about, if we can, just for a second, Scott, talk about the crew from 77 and a little bit of your memories on them. I know there was Bill Harrington, right?
That's correct. Oh, God, long time Bill Harrington.
And then what about Tex Abel?
Oh, Richard Tex Abel.
yes.
Gary Bozio's guy. Oh, yes. Very vibrant guy, always funny, always up to pranks, and he did Terry, you know. Well, yeah. Terry Bozio, that's another. I want to say this, Wolf and me got with Frank, you know, and there was only Patrick and Terry, it was the starting band, and then Frank hired, you know, and so forth, and then after whatever year and a half, whatever it was, when Terry Bozio was leaving, I thought, what's Frank Zappa going to do without Terry? How you know, so flamboyant, the look, the playing, just everything, the singing, the whole, you know, persona. There was a few rough years almost, I would say, until Vinnie Caliuta was and took over in 5 minutes.
Yeah, a few months maybe, because Vinnie just, it is amazing how the universe works. It's been proven time and time again.
Now, Vinnie was my roommate for a year and a half when he got the gig with Frank. So just
really?
Imagine. Non-stop.
Classic. Warren Cucurillo was hanging around at that time too, right? So did you meet him for the first time?
Yes. That's right. Yeah, after Adrian Belew, Warren Cucurillo, on the New York boy. And so he came around to East Coast shows, and David Moore, Frank, he wanted to meet Frank, and David Moore said, yeah. So he brought him to Frank, and Frank said, well, I'll try you out. And she did, and he hired him, And Moore certainly, in my opinion, definitely one of, well, Frank Zappa would say to one, and I've heard him say more than once, one, you're my most favorite guitar player. So coming from Frank, I'd say that has a carriage,
Absolutely.
Warren knew how to play everything right away. There was never, one of the guys that was a wrong note is nothing vocabulary, play. And I've ended up being with Warren for the last 40 years. After Frank Zappa, we had Missing Persons from day one to ground zero, and after that, like 12 years Duran Duran.
Those were some amazing times, and I'm so glad that you were a part of that with me, Thomas.
Oh yeah.
You were responsible for really that happening, honestly, because Thomas recommended me to Warren around 95 or 96.
Yeah. Oh, did he?
To do his solo things,
Yeah.
And that opened the door to Wes Waymiller and me and all that stuff that happened afterwards. So that was definitely Thomas.
I remember when I saw Dweedle's band, I think it was the Z band, and the first time it was Brian Bella, Joe Travis, and they did some shows. I was actually a tour manager a couple of times as delegated by Gail, San Diego, Speed Team, whatever we did. Now they come back. Matt Camille, of course, well, that's another thing. When I first saw my comedians I play, that totally not, I said, wait a minute, what? yeah, unbelievable. So Devo had all that going, and you know, I remember one show was at the on Hollywood, and no, Sunset, what's it called? Club Lingerie, I think it was called.
Yes.
Where Devo band played, and Frank was at the show too, watching, and I heard him say, "We're talking about Jordan. Wow, didn't see something. That's on tip, you know."
You know that. That's like the subject of another show or something. But you know, Thomas and Warren Cucurullo, didn't you sit with Frank at the Club Lingerie show?
Yes.
That was Z playing our first. It was my first professional gig ever with Dweezil. Scott Tunis was still in the band, and Frank. It was literally one of the last times Frank ever went out in public. And he sat there with, and Gail was there too, of course. That story could go on, but yeah, so that's that was a huge night for me, let me tell you.
Talk about a high compliment, you know?
Oh my God, yeah.
In the beginning, God made the light. Shortly thereafter, God made three big mistakes. The first mistake was called man. The second mistake was called woman. And the third mistake was the invention of the poodle. Now, the reason the poodle was such a big mistake is because God originally wanted to build a schnauzer, but he fucked up. Now, a long time ago, the poodle used to be a very attractive dog. The poodle had hair evenly distributed all over its small, piquant, canine-type body. That's the way it used to be. The poodle used to be a regular-looking dog. You know it's true. I guess you do, too. Oh, I have to kiss you. Oh. Anyway, listen. Check this out. The poodle used to look good. You know, the regular dogs that used to hang out in the neighborhood looked at the poodle, didn't think anything of it. You know, they didn't used to make fun of it in the old days. But the woo man, as you know, has always been much smarter than the man. That stuff is very bad for you. Throw it away. Okay. Now, you're interrupting my story. Now, listen. What is that? Is that the Tower of Power or what? Oh, no, no. It's one of those dope fiend devices. Take it away. Now, listen. The woo man has always been much smarter than the man. You know this is true. And so it was since the beginning of time. The man would do anything to get some pussy. That's why the woo man always had control over it. In the beginning, the woo man looked the man directly into the eye and said, "I'll tell you what, why don't you go get a job? Because I could use a few nice things around the house. Mainly what I need is a clipper, a scissors, and a pair of zircon encrusted tweezers. Thank you very much." And of course, the man did his duty, as they say in the trade. He went out and he got a goddamn job. Went out and pushed that broom around for about $1.298 an hour. Brought his money back to the Garden of Eden and gave that money to the woo man. The woo man ran out the back door of the Garden of Eden, went directly to the hardware store, got the clippers, the scissors, and the zircon-encrusted tweezers, and came back. And while the man was very tired from having his job, while he was sleeping, the woo man got a hold of the poodle, because the woo man had noticed earlier that the length and proportion of the poodle oral appendage, the tongue of the dog, in other words, ladies and gentlemen, was very much to her liking, except that this dog had too goddamn much hair on it. It didn't have the disco look that's so popular nowadays. And so the Woo Man set out to modify the aforementioned dog. Let me get a little visual aid. Now she took the dog and she cleaned it up a little bit. You see, she took a little bit off the back part here, around the neck, the thorax, the tootsies, got all of the unwanted extraneous material off this area, which we shall call Burbank. And then she set the little sucker up like this, really nice, got his mouth set up like that, and squatted right on him, looking down into the dog's eyes. She looked down into the dog's eyes. Do you know what she said to the dog?
You know, I was going to ask again about... So Warren came in through Davey Moore, and was that the first... I mean, I guess he had just been hanging around on that tour then, right? Other East Coast shows, and just happened to wind up in Baby Snakes, I guess.
That's right. And then, you know, Frank, after Adrian Belew was left, I guess, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, was that when David Bowie snatched him?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's when Warren became the guitar player. And for Warren, of course, it was, you know, beyond on top of the world to play with Frank. And he knew everything already, you know, so he said it was just a life-changing experience. And I remember Warren, who's, you know, extremist on all matters and full... So in London, we go to London, England. So, of course, back in the day, this was all, you know, was so vibrant. And so we go, and there was Kensington High Street Market. I don't think it exists anymore, but it was a big building with all the boutiques, you know, back then, and all the, you know, hip stuff and what have you. So Warren went there, and he bought a whole bunch of state outfits, like high heels, cow pants, earrings, the whole thing. And so Warren would introduce him, you know, totally off the cuff, and Frank would introduce him, and on guitar, Sophia Warren.
I always wondered where that came from, and I assumed it had to do with clothing.
Yeah, totally. Oh, it was so wonderful. It was just those nights in London, Dead Girls of London, oh my God.
See, it's...
Those shows in London were Warren's first shows. You know, as soon as he joined the band, the next thing he knew, he was in London, and they played the Odeon Hammersmith, right?
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Those shows are in the vault.
Oh, yeah.
There's a box set for you one of these days.
Exactly.
You know, that's what I wanted to ask you, Joe, is how did the idea for the box set come? Was it something that's been stewing for... quite a while, or, you know, because we have had, you know, things like the Halloween DVD audio and things like that, which, you know, I mean, that focused more on 78, but, you know, there's been stuff out there.
Here's the thing. It's the Halloween series, a series of releases from the vault that's all recorded, you know, from Halloween throughout the years. That's something that was, you know, that Gail was keen on doing for a long time. The only thing that's bad about that is that Frank didn't record every Halloween, and I'm sure it had to do with budget and the union and all that stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, so we don't have certain years to represent in order to do a full series, but, I mean, there is enough to do a series, but not, like, every single year being represented in the series. That's the thing. And so that kind of tainted the whole idea, but even before Gail passed, we were talking about making it a reality. And so, not that it's necessarily being shopped as a series now anymore, but what it is, you know, focusing on all the Halloween material that is in the vault. And so this first box set is going to, you know, it has all the, it's complete. It's got all six shows from the 77 run, And hopefully that's the start of more Halloween themed releases from the vault.
What are you missing? Are you missing a lot? Like, I know, for example, 74 doesn't exist, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, 74 is not there. 76 isn't there because the shows on the 29th, I think, was the Halloween recording event that year because they didn't record the Felt Forum shows. So basically, Philly 76, you know, is like a contender for a Halloween release, even though it wasn't recorded on Halloween, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But 75 is not there, and 73 is not there. 72 is there, but Frank didn't like the show that much, so he didn't keep most of it. That's the bummer.
Oh.
But there is but there is enough to do something with. And then, of course, 80 is missing. That really, really hurts. And 81 is there, complete. And I think there was Halloween shows in 84, right?
Yeah, at the Felt Forum.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't think that those are there. I don't think that those are there.
Really?
I have to reconfirm that, but I don't think they're there, sadly.
Oh.
Yeah.
Where would that be, so to speak?
Well, if 84 was not recorded, I can only think it's because he didn't want to pay for it, because it was... You know, and you have to remember that at that time he had one 24-track 3324 Sony digital PCM machine there.
So yeah.
And he was recording the shows on 24-track. But, you know, sometimes they were recording 2-track digital to U-matic tape. And I'm just surprised that none of that is around either. So, I don't know. I guess I have to do some more digging in the vault to find out.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, if you're recording in New York, and Thomas would know this, if you're recording in New York, right, you have to deal with unions and additional fees and other issues along those lines, correct? Just for people that don't know, or do you have to get permission to record or, you know, say from the venue or whatever? How does that work?
When I was cameraman and we did the big MTV show at the Palladium.
Yeah.
That day I couldn't shoot because of the union, so you know that day I couldn't be with the camera. So that's when you mentioned union. So that's exactly what it was, you know.
Aha! There you go.
And there were any number of problems like that, particularly. I mean, I'm sure. Was it just New York that you would have had those problems?
New York is a very you know, a paramount city for big union in New York, so you definitely have to do what they want. But there's other places too where there were restrictions, you know, where you couldn't record or would have had to pay a fortune to record.
Yeah, and because it was Halloween, that kind of adds to it as well. It was a holiday.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like, you know, if you look at the context of all that, it seems amazing that not only were the Halloween 77 shows recorded in full, but they were also, am I right, filmed in full?
Of the 6 shows, 4 of them were filmed.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. We would love to see that. Are those films part of Alex's project with the, you know, the transfers and the...
Well, yes, but the problem is that there's so much of it, and it costs so much that literally I think it's, you know, beyond our budget to get all of it done. So, but you know, it is something that has to be done. So, hopefully, it'll be saved from pure death.
We'll be right back.
you found all of Thomas's video, right, that he shot?
Yeah.
Which covers, was that, yeah, that would have been all of 81 and 82?
Yeah, it was the 81 and 82 tours. And the 81 stuff, Thomas, if you remember, sometimes you would switch in real time between a camera that was mounted at the desk, right, like a sound desk,
yeah,
and then you would have your handheld, and you would actually switch between the two, roughly, by the way, because it would always cause a frame drop. But you would be utilizing that in real time during the show, right?
Yeah, at times.
Okay, and one last thing I want to ask you about, Thomas. What about the shows at the Ritz in November of 81? Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember. It was a long ways upstairs, many stairs. Mm-hmm. You had to get up there. It was a great club, you know, a legendary club also.
You ran a camera during that show.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did. I don't per se remember, but I remember the club. But as far as the filming, I do not remember exactly what not. But yeah, probably.
Okay, because I was wondering if you were the only cameraman that night, if there was any other cameras that were running.
That I would not remember.
Okay, so it's just you. Because that's in the vault, too.
You have to do a Thomas box set now.
Honestly, Gail was thinking about doing a Thomas series.
Really?
Yeah.
I think the world needs that. I mean, how do we really know what happened in Palermo in 82 if we don't have that video?
that video is there.
Were you able for that show, Thomas? Were you able to film the entire show, or did the tear gas get to you and you had to run off?
No, I think I stayed on pretty long, and then when we went to the breaches, you know, underneath where the vessels were. I covered that quite a bit. I mean, Joe knows better than me probably, but
I can tell you that you actually filmed the entire show, and it wasn't that long of a show. It was an hour and 10 minutes or something, because you know it got stopped. Right, but you did get all of it.
Yeah. I mean, we were all sort of in the same place underneath the bleachers, you know, where the dressing rooms were, and you know, our bus was outside, and John Smothers comes in, bodyguard, mm-hmm. saying. Bringing in a bulletproof jacket, right? And says, "Well, Frank, there's hard ammunition going out there. That's all. Here, this is." And Frank goes, "That means I gotta go get my cigarettes."
Okay. Yeah. Classic.
That is great.
I remember also, I forgot, maybe that the same promoters, I think. But also funny that Bennett was around too,
mm-hmm.
in Italy, where I remember the after the thing, the guy just put the whole like money out of like a plastic bag on the table for the thing. That was an obvious, instead of, you know, formal payment, whatever. He just dumped it all out there, you know, whatever, they had some argument. You know, but anyway.
You actually filmed some of that.
I think so, yes. Oh, yeah. That's right, yeah. You're right.
Yeah, you're unbelievable. Right. Hey, do you remember the big piece of granite that you held in front of the camera lens during the last song of Palermo?
Right. Oh, my God. It all comes back. Yes. Yes, I did. Yeah. Oh, man.
I mean, how nobody in the band got hurt is beyond me.
Yeah, it was, yeah, we made it up and safe because it got crazy, you know, no question. And, but I think they broke a window of the tour bus, too.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, by that point, Thomas, you knew that was going to be, at the time, Frank was saying that was his last tour.
Now that you say that, I remember Frank saying at some point because you mentioned it, I could not say pinpoint when exactly said it, but he did say it at some point in my last tour. Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, I think, did he not, Joe, do you remember the Palermo tape where at the beginning of the show, I believe he says, welcome to the last show of the last tour?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
He also introduced the London show as, the last time he was going to play there.
Yeah, there was one of those London shows where he was in a supremely bad mood.
Yeah.
Do you remember him being in a kind of a bad mood during that last tour you did with him?
Yeah, he certainly was always, regardless, he was always totally on point with what had to happen, music and the performance. But you could tell Frank's mood, and so everybody would know how to react to it and how to sort of behave. You know, sometimes he was, and he had the authority to be, to adapt to whatever he felt, adapt to whatever particular point. But in general, I'd say he was certainly more in a good mood than in a bad mood. But yes, he had maybe his days, And sometimes he wasn't happy with the band performance or something, and that's obviously what a challenge it was for every player, no matter, anybody to be able to, have it always ready, the whole repertoire, every song without set list, to know those, 60, 80 songs that they have to be able to play it when Frank called it.
To go back to the Halloween 77 shows, one of the people that joined the band on stage, because there were a lot of people actually on stage during those shows, I think,
right.
Was Roy Estrada. What do you remember about Roy? Because he was kind of Roy on steroids at those shows.
Right. Well, I only knew from Mother of Invention, and then, here he is, the original band, so that's how I remember, and Frank had him there just to be there as a as whatever added attraction, whatever you want to call it.
And he absolutely is on the box set. I mean, he is definitely an added attraction, and obviously the movie too.
Yeah, he's kind of a big part of the movie. And did he do all six shows?
No, I think he was in two
of them. Okay.
Right.
It's so interesting that Frank chose to capture that particular run of shows for the movie because, you know, it's a sign of a sort of measure of his respect for that band, I think. Because it was a pretty killer band. I mean, you know, we didn't mention Patrick O'Hearn, who, you know, a genius bass player. Peter Wolf, of course, your old friend from Vienna, was a kind of a genius himself, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He also was like work, constantly improving and learning and the gear. He was very good. So yeah, no, Peter, I owe Peter Wolf certainly everything that I know as far as jazz is concerned. Peter totally educated me there from A to Z. And got me into it too, and you know, I would appreciate and know about it and follow, you know. So Peter was definitely a big influence for me learning, and you know, he also sort of turned me on to Frank Zappa, you know, at that stage, you know, Overnight Sensation, all these over the years in Vienna before we came. So yeah, always big influence for me, and also work, but been trying to get a hold of him now for a while, but I don't know, can't find him.
I was going to ask you if you knew what he was doing these days.
I have no idea. I know he's, I think he's married now at 4 at a time, and he's got, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 kids at least. But I don't know, and he was, you know, became a successful producer over the years, but I don't know what I've been trying to find him not for a year now. And I just listened to what Joe sent me.
Yeah.
Oh my God! What an unbelievable tweet.
I was really hoping that you would have a chance to hear that before we did this because I wanted to put you in the right frame of mind. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, you did.
I was just going to explain to you, Scott, that on the upcoming Halloween 77 thing, there's a section of the show on the 30th, which was a Sunday, which was a matinee show, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, anyway. But he brought Thomas up on stage with Peter Wolf and made him do tricks with Peter Wolf narrating in German. And then, after that, Roy Estrada joins the fold. And I don't think Thomas has heard that since it happened. Am I right, Thomas?
That's correct.
I didn't even know what was going on there because we've had an audience tape of that forever, but it's not very clear as to what's happening. So,
oh well, great. Now it's going to be out there for the world to consume.
That's
it's filmed too.
Yes, that is filmed too. Yes, it is. I've never seen it though, Thomas. I've never seen the film.
Will you?
Well, I think we should, try and find that.
Impossible.
I know.
Before I forget, one thing I wanted to ask you was, when you saw one of the ultimate examples of Frank's respect for you is the fact that he devoted a section of Video from Hell to you. And your work is video obsessive, so that's how, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, people were crazy gadgets and gimmicks back then, so people were telling him, his crew guys or whatever, but, you know, man, that I had everything remote, and so my whole lifestyle here is, you know, whatever quality the lifestyle that I create and the technology, of course. So he came on my birthday, he came visit me. And when he saw, I showed him sort of my little goodies here. So he brought a film crew then shortly thereafter, and filmed all that stuff. Yeah, how blessed, God blessed.
That's great. And that video of you playing Muffin Man in the hotel on your day off will live forever.
Yes. Oh yeah. What a wonderful world, you know. What a wonderful world that was, you know, back then. I mean, I'm speaking in general, and then, you know, being with Frank, and, you know, measured by today's, I just really wish I could, like to hear how Frank would comment on on today. You
know? Yes.
Yeah. Oh my God. You know. And I have my sticker still. Don't sticker. Don't blame me. I voted for that. You know?
Is there really a bumper sticker? I need one of those.
I have it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I definitely need one of those. And that's amazing. But yeah, I mean, if you ever have time, we would love to have you back on the show because, you know, this is sort of a little teaser, folks.
Yeah, a Halloween teaser.
A Halloween teaser. And there's that track. What's the name of the track? On the box set?
The name of the track is a Halloween Treat with Thomas Nordegg.
when I listened to it just now, it was so... I mean, I totally... I was in the now. I could totally remember how Frank and then hearing stuff that I sort of didn't remember and how Frank, how nice he was and, you know, it was just fantastic.
Ladies and gentlemen, a special treat tonight. It's Halloween treat time. From far off Austria, Peter Wolf and Thomas Nordegg. Come on out here. Now, there's a problem with this part of our show, ladies and gentlemen, because what they do is, well, it's little. You have to watch very closely. Eventually, we are going to require somebody from the audience to come up and help with this. Thomas, this is Thomas. Get in the light, Thomas. Very good. And this is Peter. Get in the light, Peter. Okay. Now, Thomas does things with his hands, and Peter tells you about it in German. So, take it away, Peter and Thomas.
Meine Herren und Damen, es ist unfassbar. Wir haben den Great Strange Nordic live on stage in New York City. Sehen Sie seine Hände. Oh, fantastic. Regular size deck. He cuts it and tries to make it smaller. Here it is, a little smaller. And even smaller, und noch viel kleiner, no matter how you say it. Pocket-sized deck, right here. Yeah. Es ist unglaublich. Der Meister der Karten, Thomas Nordegg. Take the print off. Der Künstler ist selbst verblüfft. Yet the print is completely off. And here it is again. Oh wow. Can't just so be magic.
Yeah, it's just like magic, ladies and gentlemen. Now listen, you have to watch very closely. I think that hey, look at what he's doing there. I bet you could really be a good pickpocket. Hey, look at what he's doing. Alright. Now I have a feeling that what you're doing... I'm supposed to pick a card? I'm picking a card, okay? You're not looking. I'm picking the card. Do I show it to the camera? Do I show it to the audience? Okay. What is that? You see what it is? Okay. Hey, don't tell them. No. Come here. Somebody already said what it was. I'm going to pick it. You look at it. Don't say what it is, all right? There. Whoops. Sorry. I'm new at this. Okay. Okay. Not on top, not on bottom. Take the top card, rub it on your shirt. Hey, how'd you do that? Are you magic? One more time. You're trying to fool me. Do the one with the balls. Oh, what? It flew away? You understand that gravity is slightly different in Austria. Okay, now here we have a ball. One ball. You see the ball. Okay. Hey, now you have two balls. All right. Only one ball. Okay. And the balls are easier to see. Actually, I think that Roy, Roy, would you come here, please? I think in order to make this really work, I think Roy should tell you what's happening. Come here.
Yes? Just explain to the audience what he's doing.
Alrighty. Well, you see, guys, he's rolling the ball, man, you know? That's the silver ball. And that's the forearm. And what are you gonna do?
Well, no, you know what I'll do?
You got two balls now, huh? Yeah, okay. Oh, you got a lighter, man. Oh, okay,
lighter.
Okay. Then what?
Lighter.
Yeah.
I think you should sing.
All righty. He has a lighter in his hand, and he has the whole world. He thinks he does by the fingers. His fingers were the one. What else can you do? Can you play with the ball and the cards too? Alrighty, little, he's playing, flipping the cards just like Bacon. I dig, ooh, that's swift, man. I love that little card. Can I see that? Love you, little heart. Love you. Ah. And then I knew before that your hands were the one.
All blank.
Yeah, all blank.
Both sides.
All sides.
Both sides.
Big ones.
Turn it over.
Little ones.
You want a regular deck?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Cars for you. Cars for me.
Oh.
All right, I think that's enough card tricks. Throw the cards into the camera so it looks really good. You ready? There, it's almost like Halloween. Now, if we can just pick up all these cards off the front part of the stage, let us resume our normal programming, ladies and gentlemen.
And that's our show. Thank you very much for listening. But before we go, I figured I would give you the lowdown on some of the material you heard in this particular episode of the show. Most of the material that you heard was from the Halloween 1977 box set. So you heard Titties and Beer from the early show, October 28th, 1977 at the Palladium in New York City. The Torture Never Stops from the early show, October 29th. A Halloween Treat with Thomas Nordegg from the October 30th, 1977 show. Jones Crusher, also from October 30th, 1977. Lather from the late show on October 28th, 1977. And Conehead, also from the late show on October 28th, 1977. In addition, we heard the Poodle Lecture from the October 30th, 1977 show, Trying to Grow a Chin, and the Black Page number 2 from the Halloween 1977 show, October 31st at the Palladium in New York City. In addition to this, we heard one other sneaky little track, which was Sofa from the show at Stadio Comunale La Favorita in Palermo, Sicily, Italy, July 14th, 1982. And we used a rather poor audience recording of that song, which was the last song from that show, because we wanted to give you an idea of what the riot sounded like that happened that day. Before we close out the show, we're going to hear a little bit more of my conversation that you heard at the top of the show with Mr. Joe Travers and a version of Punky's Whips from the October 30th, 1977 show at the Palladium in New York City. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on the ZappaCast.
See, we do have, there are tapes of those shows, but they're really not very good quality. So you can't hear, I mean, even by audience recording standards, they're just not that good. You know, I mean, they're documents, but you can't really hear, like, for example, the bit with Thomas on it. You can't really hear what's going on. Not really.
Right. My gosh, think of it how it was recorded. Some old portable cassette, probably. You know,
most likely cassette by that time,
without a good microphone,
on 120-minute tape. So the tape is real thin,
yeah, real thin and real fragile. And oh gosh, yeah,
yeah. I mean, this is going to
throw
melt
your
that.
Your legs away. You don't need them anymore. Now you've got, you know, pristine quality the entire run.
It really doesn't get any better than that. You know,
it really doesn't.
What they're going to want me to ask is about what you found in the vault for film elements related to those shows.
Right. You know, it's real hard to tell. There's many, many, many tape boxes in there, but it's hard to tell what's an original negative, what's a work print. I mean, they are labeled as such, but it's really hard to find some of this stuff. It's really confusing. But I will say that back about maybe eight years ago, we had resurrected Frank's chem table, which is a chem editing table, which you see him working on in you know, a lot of his films. When you, like the Dub Room Special, for instance, there's a lot of footage of the chem editing table.
Sure.
And so when we got that up and running and that was working, I started utilizing that chem table to help identify what some of the film elements were in the vault. And so I actually did put up some Baby Snakes outtakes up on that Ken table so that I could see what some of that stuff was. And I remember vividly looking at some footage of The Torture Never Stops. It was silent because I didn't have the sound synced up to it. I was just looking at the picture elements. But what I remember is a handheld behind Frank as he's doing the guitar solo, and the stage is all very smoky. So, you know, the dry ice smoke, that was part of the effect from that.
Yeah.
But, unfortunately, it's the same thing that we dealt with the Roxy, where all of a sudden, the film runs out.
Huh.
And there's a large gap of footage that just wasn't captured, and then all of a sudden it cuts back in, and by then it could be the end of the solo at that point. You know, it's like there's large gaps in this stuff, so it may not be complete. We've yet to really dive in to spend the time on researching and finding the elements that were used in the main movie. But I can tell you that it's extremely expensive dealing with film and trying to get this stuff transferred. Even if you just want to see what it is, you have to spend the money to transfer it first.
Sure.
Even if, you know, and so it's not cheap. And we have been utilizing as much of the Kickstarter budget as we possibly could for as much film, but we're getting to the end of that now, and unfortunately I don't think we're going to get a chance to get all of the Baby Snake stuff transferred on the Kickstarter budget.
Sure.
There will be some, there probably will be some other avenues that we can travel down to get that stuff preserved, but you know, so we'll just have to see. But again, even though we haven't transferred all of that Baby Snakes outtake footage, I do remember seeing a little bit of it, and I could see the writing on the wall with the frustration. Like, I could just see it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I could tell. So, but you never know.
That's all 35 millimeter, right? That's all 30.
No, it was shot in 16 millimeter. And
was it?
Blown up to 35.
Huh.
Yeah. And the thing of it is not all of the shows were filmed. The two shows on the 28th were not filmed. And then starting on the 29th, those two shows were filmed, and then the 30th, and then the 31st. So I guess of the six shows, two of them were not filmed.
And would it be safe to assume that the ones that were filmed were not necessarily filmed in their entirety?
Yeah, it would be safe to assume that. We've yet to determine that, but I would say that most likely not all of it is filmed. Yeah, I mean, you know how much that must have cost them back then.
Oh, sure.
With Halloween being the Halloween night being the main focus, you know, it would make sense to me that they wouldn't have spent the money to film every single moment of every single show. But I don't know for sure, so I can't say.
You know, it's kind of impressive that he could really put the money toward it anyway, because if you look at what was going on at the time, he was being sued, or there were lawsuits going back and forth with Herb Cohen, and of course the infamous Warner Brothers lawsuit, which was really just ramping up at that point. There's a lot of I'm sure there's a lot of Warner Brothers references in these shows.
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right, Scott. And you get six different versions of titties and beer to prove it. Yeah, it's really fun, man. It's really fun to hear all the different versions. And you know, you think about the world premiere of the movie, Baby Snakes, came out in 79.
Mm-hmm.
So it took Frank a while to finish the film because, you know, look at how much he toured in 78. And look at what he did in 78 simultaneously.
Yeah.
You know, he was touring, what, 5 to 6 months out of the year in 78 and doing new band members. And, you know, the whole Munich, Germany stuff that was filmed in 1978 at the Circus Krohn. You know, there was other projects happening simultaneously while he was working on Baby Snakes. And so it took him a while to get it done, but in the end, it ended up being super worth it, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's just, like I said, you know, Baby Snakes for me, when I was first starting to really get into Frank, so you're looking at, well, this would be the VHS days, so 86, 87, that was the gateway, that was one of the big gateway drugs for me, so that was, you know, I'd sit there and watch all 3 hours of it, I had no problem with it.
You know, I'm the same way, but unfortunately, I had the first edit, the 90-minute version, which ended up being the European edit.
Yeah.
That version was the one that was available in mail order first.
That's
and
right.
Frank did, yeah, and the double tape VHS Honker Home Video version didn't come out until after that. So for the longest time, I had just the short version.
Which was just the music, right, primarily?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. But when the double tape version came out, it was like the heavens parted.
You get a lot more Roy in that one, Roy Estrada.
Yeah. Oh man, I'll tell you, he's really funny on this stuff. It's just great. I think overall everybody's going to be really happy with how well those shows were documented and how well this box set goes into detail with these shows. So really exciting, and I hope that everyone enjoys it, and happy Halloween to everybody. And,
yes, indeed.
Looking forward to more. Music is the best.
That's right.
In today's rapidly changing world, rock groups appear every 15 minutes utilizing some new promotional device. Some of these devices have been known to leave irreparable scars on the minds of foolish young consumers. One such case is seated before you, little skinny Terry Ted Bozio, that cute little drummer.
That's right!
Terry recently fell in love with a publicity photo of a boy named Punky Meadows.
Oh, Punky!
Lead guitar player from a group called Angel. In the photograph, Punky was seen with a beautiful shiny hairdo in a semi-profile which emphasized the pooched-out succulence of his insolent, pouting rictus, the sight of which drove the helpless young drummer mad with desire.
I can't stand the way he pouts, 'cause he might not be pouting for me.
Punky Meadows pouting for you? You mean, bet, sailor.
You mean he's not pouting for me? His hair's so shiny and it's done real nice till I squirm with ecstasy.
We'll be right back. Pinky, Porky, give me your lips to die on.
I promise not to come in your mouth. Pinky, Pinky, your album's the shit. It's all wrong.
I ain't really queer, but if he ever got near, Steven Tyler would pay to see Tennessee.
Pumpkin's lips.
His hair's so shiny, I love his hair. I love his teeth and his gums inside.
Pumpkin,
what is it, you
you're
homo?
An angel. You're too much.
God. The voice of my thoughts in my lonely teenage room. No shit.
That keeps the girls away.
That's true.
Skin
doom.
Is what the doctors say.
And that makes me wonder. I wonder what Punky is rehearsing today. I'll just go over and hear him play. His hair is so pretty, I'd like to bite his neck. I heard a rumor he's more fluid than Jeff Beck.
A little fond of Chiffon in a
little. That's all it is, I swear. Pucky's lips. Pucky's lips. Oh! I love his hair while he donkey chips. Yeah, I love his blink and his clank, clank, clank. Why? Maybe he'd like to yank my crank. Yank it, Pucky! Yank it harder! Yank it all night long! Come on, Pumpkin! Get funky!
And then he told me now,
I ain't queer.
Hey,
I ain't gay.
Hey, hey, he's a little boy with a bar in the wrist. All right,
yeah.
Tommy Mars, Terry Bozio, Peter Wolf, Ed Mann. Thanks for coming to the show.
And that's our show. The ZappaCast was produced and edited by Scott Parker. Production assistance by Joe Travers and Melanie Starks. This podcast and all of the musical selections contained therein are copyrighted worldwide by the Zappa Family Trust. All rights reserved. Big thanks to Ahmed Zappa and all at Zappa.com. On behalf of the ZappaCast team, this is Scott Parker saying thank you for listening. And until next time, good night, boys and girls.
It's been lovely working for you this evening. Good night.
And now for the main event of this episode of the ZappaCast, ladies and gentlemen, we are joined by...
Wait a minute.
What? Okay.
What about Thomas Nordegg?
Oh, that's true. Him. Well, okay. And now for the preview. No, I'm kidding.
All right, do it again. Just go ahead.
Oh, that's right. That was a good catch. I don't know about that. Fuck.
Yeah, I don't want this to be the main event.
Oh, that's true. That's true. You know, yeah, don't do that to Thomas.
And everything, it's all Halloween. It's all good. So anyway, go ahead.